Good morning. A Fed hike and a mortgage rate bump earlier this week, plus increasing credit card debt, is the story around the country. Your hero's Carl Bonham puts that into perspective with the annual Hawaii and Asia Pacific forecast released today. Meanwhile, as HECO is looking to increase its rates, the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative is lowering theirs. Life of the Land's Henry Curtis compares the reasons for the two scenarios. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergrift. Mike Travis is a local author whose new memoir is Faded Jeans to Army Greens, a story of Army life from basic to Desert Storm. And awards-winning sports photographer Robert Beck looks back on some of the memorable images from his career.
It's a Friday, December 16th. That's the conversation coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to a Friday on The Conversation and everywhere else, too. It's nice, though, to come to the end of the week. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and to my right, as always, Chris Vandercook. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. So some rates are going up and some rates are going down.
If you're talking about energy costs, that would be true in Hawaii. We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, higher electric bills may be coming for Oahu's HECO customers. For the first time in 6 years, Hawaiian Electric Company says it plans to increase rates due to rising internal costs. Meanwhile, on Kauai, customers of that island's utility cooperative are now enjoying an 18% decrease in rates from the level they were at 8 years ago. And the smaller bills have arrived along with a growing renewable portfolio to now over 30%. Life of the Land Executive Director Henry Curtis joins us now with more on this divergent energy story. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I mean, it's rather ironic that we see both of these stories coming down, you know, ostensibly in the same week. But for years now, both have been working toward producing green energy. Why is it that one has been able to do it so well and the other seemingly not so?
Kauai Island Utility Cooperative is owned by its members, and therefore the people who are in charge and the people who are receiving the energy are the same, and there is no incentive to bloat the company. Whereas Hawaiian Electric Company, the Public Utilities Commission has specifically asked Hawaiian Electric to find ways of cost containment. And that would be one of the major issues in this proceeding, whether the utility is bloated or whether it has actually sought to find ways of containing its runaway costs.
According to HECO's CEO, Al Noshima, they say that, you know, the cost for providing service to Oahu's customers has been going up since 2011, that they've just been sort of containing it themselves, but now they want to have a rate increase to be able to pass on the real cost of the rate. What do you make of that?
Well, that's a statement now, but of course during the Next Era debacle, where they were trying to take over Hawaiian Electric and Next Era proclaimed that there was a lot of fat that they could carve out of HECO. So it's a change of positions.
How do we see what that fat might be? Would there be any impulse to be able to see what was there or what could be there to carve out now?
Well, interestingly enough, merger proceedings gathered all sorts of interveners. I mean, 30 interveners jumped into that. But in a rate case, traditionally, virtually no one intervenes, and therefore no entity actually gets into the mess and figures out what's going on. The PUC will be the decision maker. The consumer advocate represents ratepayers. Life of the Land will intervene. But except for that, it is perhaps possible that no one else seeks to intervene. On Oahu, the Department of Defense will probably intervene. On the Big Island, DOD will not intervene.
that almost seems strange for people to hear, given, as you say, so many interveners during the proceedings in which the merger was being considered. As we move forward now, given the fact that we already pay such high rates, do you have any sense of what the PUC might be predisposed to do?
Well, one of the issues is a rather complicated financing mechanism called decoupling, where you separate the oil, the changes day to day from the allowed rate of return, delinking oil, basically, to your return. And in the case of Maui, they suggested the return on equity should be lowered because there's less risk to shareholders. The utility is going to fight that in this case. They don't want their rate of return on equity to be affected by the fact that they're a less risky company.
Wasn't the whole point of decoupling, as we began to discuss it years ago, to ensure that the, if you will, the nut that the company had to cover would be so, and that that would free them to be able to produce the green energy that everyone was clamoring for?
Yes. And there seems to be a slowdown on rooftop solar and other forms of energy, green energy coming on. The slowdown has been over the last couple of years. And so it seems like they're dragging their feet on getting more renewables on and at the same time asking for higher rates. And that's not going to be very popular.
You mentioned solar. We were told even just 18 months ago, 2 years ago, that with the fact that more people could not be able to connect and that they would have to wait in queue or even when that was lifted, that solar would be ramping down. But now we've seen it to be veritably gutted. What happens to solar from this point forward?
In order to get more solar onto the grid, you can put it on as long as you don't export it to the grid, as long as you use it only on site, which means that you have a load between 10 and 2 p.m. that you can absorb that production or that you have a battery. But while a number of people are applying for that, far less than under net energy metering, only two systems have been approved by the utility in the last year. So it's basically a gutting.
Which we heard was going to happen when net metering ended and that there were warnings and people would be dropping out of that. The idea that you wouldn't be paid market rate, you couldn't feed anything back in, there wasn't a circle that one could be involved with in creating energy, feeding it in, taking it when you needed it, that when that circle was broken, solar would also find itself broken. Is there any way that that can come back?
It can if we separate Hawaiian Electric out. We say instead of Hawaiian Electric generating and competing against other generators and owning the grid, the utility should own the grid and sell off all its generation. That way it doesn't favor one generation over another and it can adopt the state policy and move far more aggressively into renewables. But as long as the utility owns fossil fuel power plants, then those will be forever competing against renewable energy companies.
Which kind of brings us back to the beginning of the conversation with the KIUC, the fact that you have a cooperative that's owned and directed by those people who receive the energy from it. When we were talking so much last year at during session and even before session started, the idea that we should be looking at other alternatives was very big. Haven't heard so much about that in the last little while, but is there a movement to look at other alternatives for Oahu customers, and would that be as effective as, say, it has been on Kauai, where you're dealing with far fewer people and a much smaller place?
One of the issues is that if you buy solar with a battery combined, you get a tax credit. But if you buy solar now and you get a tax credit and then you buy a battery later, there's no state tax credit for that. I know both the Senate under Senator Lorraine Inouye and the House under Representative Chris Lee are looking at reviving a bill that would provide a tax credit for energy storage at the residential level. And that would enable a lot of batteries to come on, which not only helps the homeowner at that particular home, but can help stabilize the grid, which would allow more solar to be entered onto the grid.
For the moment, we're going to leave it there, but thank you, Henry, for coming in.
Thank you. Beth
Henry
Ann.
Kernis is the executive director of the organization Life of the Land.
And then we take it higher. Oh, we gonna rock down to Electric Avenue. And then we take it higher. Oh no.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:13, and coming up in the show, a revealing memoir of Army life. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're first going to reflect on yesterday's quiz when we asked you to identify the shortest straight line distance between any part of Hawaii and another U.S. state. Now, in case you forgot, that was between Kauri Atoll in the northwest Hawaiian Islands and Amaktiknik Island in Alaska's Aleutian Islands. Today we're talking, or rather taking, our geographic inquiry international. Yesterday we learned that more than 1,500 miles separate Hawaii from another American state. Fortunately, if international travel is on your agenda, there are closer options. It's actually possible to depart Hawaii and arrive in a foreign country traveling less than those 1,500 miles. So can you tell us which foreign neighbor lies the shortest possible distance from Hawaii? If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and we'll send you an HPR prize by the shortest possible route if you're the winner.
I'm Andrew Rosen from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
They took away my faded jeans.
They took away my faded jeans.
And gave me all this army green.
And gave me all this army green.
They took away my faded jeans.
They took away my faded jeans.
And gave me all this army green.
And gave me all this army green.
Young men and women join the Army knowing it will change their lives, but they can't know how it will affect them. Mike Travis has written a memoir of his Army years called Faded Jeans to Army Greens, a story of Army life from basic to Desert Storm. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Chris, and good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Sure. You were in during Desert Storm. Well, you had done a two-year hitch and then were called back for Desert Storm. Is that right?
Correct. I was. I had spent 2 years basically in the States. Fort Ord was my main permanent unit as a petroleum supply specialist, fuel truck driver. And then I got out, and then I got called back as part of Operation Desert Storm. They called back many soldiers as part of inactive ready reserve units.
What did that feel like?
Well, thank you for sharing that cadence. There's actually another military cadence that says, got a letter in the mail, go to war, go to jail. And that's sort of exactly what happened to all of us. We got a letter in the mail. So I sort of, when I got out, I kind of had a feeling already things were building up in Kuwait and things like that. So I sort of wasn't sure if I was going to be called back or not. But so it wasn't a huge surprise when I got the letter in the mail in January of that year, 1991. But, you know, it was still kind of defeating because I was back in college and starting the civilian life.
Well, it was a very uncertain time. I mean, it was a huge deployment, half a million troops.
Yes,
certainly the largest since the Vietnam War, and probably the largest at a time since the Second World War in terms of half a million suddenly deployed like that.
Right, and what's funny is that, you know, when I went to recruitment this crew recruitment station when I first joined, you know, you sign up for 8 years and it's active duty time and inactive time. Mm-hmm. And the recruiter was kind of joking, oh, don't worry, inactive time. They never call people back. They haven't done that since Vietnam. So no worries. And then ironically, we all got called back.
Pretty much been doing that ever since.
Yeah, it seems that way. Yes.
Well, what kind of anxieties did you have going in? I mean, given what we knew and didn't know at the time.
Going into the military?
Yeah, or, going overseas.
Oh, to Desert Storm. Well, I knew that we needed to, help out Kuwait. I mean, there were a lot of people that were saying it was just about war, but Saddam Hussein did take over an entire country and was holding it hostage. So, and the nice thing was that at the time, President Bush had a coalition of many, many countries around the world. So it was something we needed to do. There was a lot of fears, though, from all of us, mainly because we didn't know what kind of nerve gas or they were talking about all these chemical weapons that he had that he could use against us. And also the elite, the Republican elite guard was scary. So going over there, I really actually didn't think I was coming back when I left. So I said goodbye to people and, you know, made amends with, you know, people that were, you know, enemies in the past and things because I didn't think I was coming back.
That's a lot for a young man, 23 years old at the time, to take in.
Yes, yes. And so many of us were facing that. You know, I got called back and we had to go back to Fort Lee, Virginia, where I had my original training. And so we all waited in these massive lines while we got reissued all of our equipment. And, you know, I at the time I got to meet James Tatum, and that was one of the catalysts for me writing this book was I met him, and he had also been called back, and we became really good friends in those few weeks when we were doing the training, and then we went over together to Saudi Arabia.
And these are really close friendships.
Yes. Well, you spend so much time together, and as we were talking earlier, Chris, at that time in the early the late 80s and early 90s, there was no cell phones, there wasn't iPads. So, I mean, there wasn't much to do except write letters, which I've shared a lot of letters in my book that I wrote to my parents and family members. But, you know, you spent a lot of time talking and playing cards and things like that. So you really got to know people, at a deeper level.
Interacting with each other the way people did before the iPhones
true.
Took
yes.
over, right?
Yes, yes.
Well, at the same time, you sounds as if you always were a writer in terms of someone who got a lot of benefit from putting his thoughts down on paper.
Well, I did write a lot of letters, and that was nice. When I went to write the book, I asked my mom, and of course she had kept a lot of the letters, so that was great because I could use that to help write it. And I'd also written – when I was in Kuwait, I wrote a lot of journals at that time. But – I don't know if I ever considered myself a writer, but going through education and getting a PhD, I spent a lot of time writing, and so I guess I've developed that skill over time.
Well, you know, at the same time, the kind of writing you do when you don't think you're a writer can be very honest stuff. Yeah,
true. So, I really wanted to write the book to honor my fellow soldier James Tatum, the person I was talking about earlier, because he did not make it back. So he was we were in barracks in Saudi Arabia, and they were calling people out into formations, and then they were giving you orders to go up to various units and join those units because we weren't assigned to a unit yet. Mm-hmm. As the inactive ready reserve. And I got the call to go to an armory division up at the front lines. And at the time, we both thought, you know, he was giving me a hug saying goodbye, thinking I was the one that was probably not coming back. And it turns out that just a couple days later, those barracks were hit by a Scud missile. And it was actually the biggest loss of American troops in the Operation Desert Storm. Over 20 soldiers were lost when the Scud missile hit the barracks. So I wanted to honor him by, you know, talking about him in this book and sharing his story.
It has to have been a kind of a haunting, it could have been you, sensation.
Right, yeah. And I did feel that because I didn't find out until I actually got back to the States that he had passed away. I had seen the I think it was a Time magazine article that showed all the faces of the people that were lost in that. I mean, when we were over there, we kind of heard, but they didn't want to tell us a lot of the bad things. You know, when you're a soldier, you don't tell them, oh, well, barracks just got hit. You know, you tell them we're doing well, the war's going well and everything. You don't hear the full story.
Yeah.
So when I got back, it made me think, now I'm sort of living, I have to live for two lives now. And so I actually, I tried contacting the family when I got back, but I think they were overwhelmed with media coverage. But I did, before I finished the book over the summer, I actually was able to get a hold of the parents, Neil and Carol Tatum, and I had a great conversation with the dad, and I even kind of broke down when I was talking to him, just, you know, because it's still so emotional to think about. I don't think about it every day, but to think about, you know, just the luck of the draw that kept me here and him no longer.
Well, it's a powerful memoir, Mike, and thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for letting me share it.
Mike Travis is the author of Faded Jeans to Army Greens, a story of Army life from basic to Desert Storm. You can find out more about him and his book on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Documents unsealed by the U.S. District Court allege that a retired police officer was part of a conspiracy in the original case involving HPD Chief Kealoha's stolen mailbox. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the latest reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. And boy, this just keeps getting weirder and weirder.
And more bizarre, absolutely. Well, let's just remember for a second, 3.5 years ago, when the chief said that their mailbox had been stolen and that Mrs. Kealoha's uncle had been the one to steal it. Now, during the trial, the federal public defender of the uncle said that he had proof that the uncle had been framed. Remember that part? And the trial ended in a mistrial when Chief Kealoha improperly testified. You and I talked about that
right.
at length. Then the case went to the FBI. So what was revealed yesterday in the information that was unsealed by the court?
This is Nick Ruby's report. He's been following this closely. And a former police officer, Neil Silva, who was actually part of that special criminal unit that was investigating the mailbox theft, has been charged along with five co-conspirators. They are not named. The accusation is that they were, in fact, trying to frame Gerard Pu'ana. That is the uncle of Catherine Kealoha. And remember, Catherine Kealoha is a city prosecutor herself. And the suggestion is that the Kealohas originally were trying to get the upper hand in a family dispute over money. That's what this all comes down to. But this new charge is quite serious. It's a felony-level charge. It's saying that Silva and these other co-conspirators falsified reports, that they lied to federal investigators, that their whole notion was to try and put Gerard Pu'ana behind bars.
When you think about how all of this stems from a potential fight within a family and how it has had a very public outgrowth, this thing just keeps going, you know, on and on. Is there any chance of understanding who those other conspirators are? How deep into the investigation is it so that we might know who else was involved and if that were including the Kealohas?
That was something that Nick raised in his story, that it could be that others will be identified being indicted here. And you wonder just who that might be. There's also a suggestion that maybe this federal investigation is nearing an end with this conspiracy charge coming forth. By the way, I should say that an attorney for the Kealoha says, look, this is all a scare tactic. All they're trying to do is shake the tree, if you will, get other witnesses to come forward against the Kealohas. So that is in defense of the Kealohas in this case right here. But, boy, it just keeps – just remember, just yesterday, Pu'ana himself filed a lawsuit against the KLOA, saying he was a victim of abuse from the police and from a malicious prosecution.
And isn't that also why Miles Briner, the attorney for the KLOA, is saying that this is seeming that it's just, you know, too coincidental, despite the fact that the idea that the uncle was framed has been around for quite a while?
Right. That's exactly what he said. Look, this just smells. You can't possibly have this happen. And by the way, Puana is supposed to be appearing, Silva, rather, is to appear in court today, and a plea deal appears to be in the works. We'll have a new development. We'll be following this, as we always have, Beth Ann, until it ends. I hope it ends.
Well, I hope so, too. But meanwhile, we'll have more to talk about as we look at this case that just keeps on going and getting even more bizarre. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend.
You too. I'll talk to you Monday.
You bet. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. And this being a Friday, as we always do, we take a look at what's coming from HPR's news department in the coming week. And to help us do that, HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, joins us now. Well, here we are. We're coming into the week right before Christmas, and a lot of people are in the holiday spirit. Yes, we're still seeing news happen, but taking a softer approach for next week, it seems.
It's true. Well, you know, holidays, depending on your holidays, which holidays you're wanting to celebrate. I think Festivus may have passed. But at any rate, we have some things going on. Arts and culture world, not that that's necessarily tied to holidays, but there's something exciting coming here, which is a first, actually. The first statewide ceramics show in Hawaii. Kind of hard to believe that it's taken us long to pull this off, but that is opening. Actually, it's opening tonight, so something, if folks are looking for something tonight, 5:30 to 8 at the Honolulu Museum School, but the exhibit itself is going to linger for a while. Couple of interesting twists on this, on ceramics. It's a juried exhibit, so the jurors and artists coming down from Kauai, David Kuraoka, from Hawaii, taught many years in San Francisco Bay Area, including San Jose State, which, if you're not familiar with this, has quite the history of ceramics, ceramics education, potters, all kinds of art coming out of there. And so he's going to be in on this. There's a lot more to say about this. I'll leave it to Noe Tanigawa to say it. But,
and to talk about the different types of ceramics and what's being used.
Yeah, exactly. And she also did add that the ceramics community in Hawaii is noteworthy for being warm and engaged. Aging and welcoming. So the show's got that on top of everything else.
Well, that's a good thing. But yeah, as we're talking about being warm and welcoming, certainly Hokulea has received both as it's been traveling around and now is going to be heading home.
Yeah, lots of aloha on that. Gotten word about the timing of that. Coming home to Honolulu this coming June, putting in at Magic Island, which will make it almost exactly 3 years, 40,000 nautical miles on this trip. That's astounding. And as you know, we've been following them along the way, not quite shadowing them or, stalking them, but just sort of keeping up with them. And as they make their way down the East Coast, they have made it to Florida, to Miami. Next up is Panama. And so Molly Solomon is going to be along with an update on that.
Very good. And as we come into next week, too, a little bit of music.
Yeah. So, you know, I know Chris on the show with some holiday music, this and that, different kinds of music. Dave Lawrence sat down recently with Chick Corea, jazz pianist and composer. Calling Chick Corea jazz pianist is kind of like saying, oh, when Michael Jordan played a little basketball. But some great stories and some entertainment. And we'll have that coming up next week as well.
All right. Good stuff to look forward to as we come into next week. Thank you, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. This week, the Fed raised its short-term interest rate for the second time in 10 years. Mortgage rates ticked upward just a bit, and average American household credit card debt clocked in at a little over $16,000. Not necessarily good news for Hawaii households, where according to the latest UH Economic Research Organization report, median family income already lags 4% behind pre-recession levels. UHERO Executive Director Carl Bonham joins us now with more from today's Hawaii and Asia Pacific forecast. Good morning, and
good
thank
morning,
you for
Bethany.
Coming here. There is so much uncertainty surrounding so many things, given the fact that we'll be facing a new administration, that to, you know, look at our economy, which looks, you know, you can say that it's, you know, reasonably healthy, but still, given some of these other factors that we're looking at, how do you advise people to begin to at first even approach what Hawaii's economic forecast might be?
Great question this time of the morning. It's it's challenging. I mean, you have, while the, you know, the visitor industry, the construction industry are doing well, the aggregate numbers, total personal income is rising and rising. Probably 2015 was the best year, as we've talked about in the past. The growth rates are fairly elevated. Inflation rates have been low. Interest rates have been low. But then you've got, you know, some overhang of people who haven't reentered the labor force. You know, you've got people who are working, more people working part-time than would like to be. And you've got the issue that you know, median household income has lagged behind, which is a symptom of it, basically income inequality, where the growth that we're seeing is mostly at the top of the income distribution. And this is not new, right? I mean, the numbers that we're talking about basically have been flat since around the late 1990s, early 2000s. And that's true in Hawaii as well as the rest of the country. So, I mean, the outlook is positive in the sense that when you have strong overall income growth, it does help to pull everybody up. At the same time, it's been much slower than you would like to see.
And still lagging, which seems to be the real part of it. As we've talked about many times, without being able to predict with any sort of certainty at all, what happens as we begin to hit the next recession, and looking at whatever preparations people should be considering now, given where the Hawaii economy is, given all the uncertainty going forward, is there anything that you think is an absolute must-do now as people consider what they may be seeing outside their window when they're seeing a lot of building and they're seeing that things are a little bit rosier than they have been in the past, so that they don't get caught when that eventual recession begins to happen, or at least when a decline begins to happen?
Well, so when, you know, we're not forecasting a recession. You know, it's a topic. I mean, we're not really on a recession look or watch, if you will. We foresee growth slowing, mostly as, you know, we've got several more years, I think, of pretty robust tourism growth, as we're adding quite a bit to the visitor plant. We've got several more years of modest growth in construction activity. You mentioned the, you know, rising credit card debt. I mean, the primary thing that people have to do, essentially in preparation for the next downturn, which will happen, right? It's going to come, and we talk a lot in this report about the various things that could cause that, whether it's the Fed raising interest rates too fast because of too much fiscal stimulus, or the currency strengthen. You know, the dollar becomes so strong against foreign currencies that basically visitors stop spending, or we stop exporting from the U.S., all those things that could lead to the next downturn. One of the key things going into a downturn is not having too much debt. In other words, as your income stagnates or your income declines, if you lose a job, the more debt you carry. And this was the story of the last crisis, was way too much debt on the part of governments, households, et cetera. And if you look at the consumer balance sheet in the United States, it's actually in really good shape. Historically, we have some of the lowest debt to personal income ratios that we've had, or financial obligations. Actually, the Federal Reserve publishes a data series. And while it's true that consumer payments have been increasing as they've taken on more debt, mortgages have shrunk, and overall financial obligations for households are at levels we haven't seen since the 30, 40 years ago. relative to their incomes.
Right, but for buyers who, I mean, for consumers who have yet to purchase a home and they're watching the mortgage rates uptick just a little bit, and if they're still carrying a lot of debt, that, you know, $16,000 average household debt sounds like, you know, quite a lot when you think about the fact that maybe, you know, there's not going to be that much growth, real income growth for people nationally and certainly in Hawaii. And the fact that, you know, people are using their credit cards to be able to bridge that gap of daily needs. They're not going out there and buying a, you know, a beautiful piece of jewelry. They're trying to be able to just keep themselves going from point A to point B and
so,
buy the necessities.
So again, it's sort of that issue of what is, you know, what is a healthy economy, and in any sort of healthy economy. So I was just referring to the headline numbers or the aggregate numbers on consumer debt and household financial obligations, and on average, households are in a much better place than they have been in 15, 20, 30 years. But there are that's the average. And there certainly are households who are using credit cards to get by from month to month and racking up more credit card debt. And that, you know, that's a reflection in part of inadequate wage growth, which we're actually beginning to see reasonably good evidence that wages are starting to rise more rapidly. Not as fast as we would like, not as fast as in expansions of 10, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, but much more rapidly than in the last 4 or 5 years.
Carl, if you had to do a reality check of all of this, though, given the fact that there is so much uncertainty around policy, what may happen when we hit January 21st and that point onward, is there something that you think that we should be paying attention to in a different sort of way now, given that uncertainty? Or is, you know, the sort of the real takeaway is, look, the economy looks pretty good based on this snapshot right now, but really you've got to look to your own households and begin to slice off debt where you can and to be able to retool as much as you can now, because we don't know what may happen in future.
Well, but that story is always true, right? I mean, it's always at the individual household, individual business level. And, you know, is there something we should be looking at differently? I don't think so. I think we just need to be more aware. I mean, basically the idea is that policy risk has increased, and the risk that policies would be bad and has been here for the last decade. I mean, it's been one of our primary focuses on risk, whether it was sequestration or policy at the state level or at the county level. Those seem to be the big Brexit. Take your pick. Our sense is it's heightened now, and so it requires more vigilance.
For the moment, we'll leave it there, but we'll talk next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Economics Professor Carl Bonham is the Economic Research Organization's executive director and one of its founding members. The UHERO forecast for Hawaii and the Asia-Pacific region for 2017 is out today. We've posted the public summary on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Meli Kaliki Maka, Haole Maki Hikiho. This is Burl Burlingame. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. There's a thread entwining pa'akai farming in Hanapepe, Malama, Kauai, and a boy selling ice cream to an attorney in London practicing international law. Binding these diverse elements together is Wayne Raposo. He was the recipient of a Hawaii Community Foundation scholarship himself. When he became a successful attorney, he set up the Raposo Kama'aina Fund, of which Pa'akai Farming and Malama Kauai were recipients. It's an example of the continuation of the cycle of giving. For people who have benefited from generosity tend to give back in the future. Wayne created another college scholarship, and Benji Buckleig was selling ice cream when he received his. It got him to the Wharton School, where he earned a degree in finance. Now, on his way to success, Benji told Wayne he plans to help others, just like you did. And the cycle continues. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we continued where we left off yesterday, looking at Hawaii's geographic location. When we learned yesterday that Alaska is the closest U.S. state to Hawaii, today we look at Hawaii's international neighbors. We wanted to know which foreign country lies the shortest possible distance from one of the Hawaiian islands. And as in yesterday's question, perspective is important. Hawaii covers a large area and point of origin matters. However, we were looking for the shortest possible distance between anywhere in Hawaii and a foreign country. Using that as our criterion, the answer is clear. Regular listeners of the show might even remember that in March, we interviewed Anote Tong, the former president of the tiny island republic of Kiribati. And that's today's answer. Nobody got that today, but at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And now I just want to give you an update on our Radio Flyers campaign that lifted off on Monday. We have $1,720 to go on the matching gift of $10,000 from Dr. Tom Kosasa. And right now, of course, your donation could be doubled and then multiplied again as we transfer 10 Hawaiian miles for every dollar to Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children Family Fund. Those miles will help fly neighbor island families to and from Honolulu so that they can be with their hospitalized young children. And if you want to donate, you can go online to hawaiipublicradio.org or call us at 808-955-8821. Now, also a program note, Science Friday will not be heard today. That's in order to bring you special coverage from the president that'll be following the conversation.
The sports photographer must capture moments that are here and gone in a millisecond, and his skills depend on quick reactions. But they're also about relationships with athletes. And Robert Beck, a staff photographer with Sports Illustrated magazine, says it's those relationships he values the most. He's in town for a workshop, and he's with us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. How are you doing?
All right. You've been at innumerable big-ticket sporting events over the years, and does the excitement ever go away?
You know, it doesn't, but it's kind of a different type of excitement, whereas, you know, a fan goes and they're really pulling for one team or another. For me, it's just kind of the anticipation of what we can capture while we're at the event, and what it's more of like a total immersion into the event. But yeah, it's never ending. I'm always excited to go to something, to one of the games, one of the events.
And you know, you go in without knowing, obviously without knowing what the result is going to be, but you're going to want to get that one still image that kind of tells the whole story, if possible, in a single image. You have no idea what that's going to be, can you?
Exactly. And every finish is different. Sometimes, obviously, a game is over far before the end of the game itself, but it seems the bigger games, you know, let's say a Super Bowl or World Series, something like that, generally comes down towards the end. And, of course, your excitement just builds and builds and builds until that point. And, yeah, the object is, I mean, we're hired to try and get that one piece of action that's going to be, you know, the biggest part of the story. So it can be a little tense at times.
I can only imagine. You know, I'm thinking of a lot of the images that I'm looking at of yours. Well, for one thing, they take an unusual sort of non-traditional perspective. There's a great silhouette shot of a golfer framed with a tree on the right-hand side of the frame. But also in one of your most famous shots, that of Brandi Chastain after the U.S. soccer win, when she pulled off her jersey, in the shot, she's in sharp focus, and her teammates are all rushing up behind to greet her, and they're not in focus. And had they been in focus, it would have ruined the shot because the emphasis needs to be on her. So it's almost as if you planned it, you know, you had just the right lens and the right camera at that right second, but yet you couldn't have planned it. How does something like that come about?
Well, that's really comes down to your depth of field and what aperture. And, you know, it might be a little technical for some of our listeners, but, yeah, I tend to shoot what we call wide open.
Right.
And part of the reason is in sports, of course, it's very fast-paced. So we have to use a larger aperture so we let more light in and we can use a faster shutter speed. And a bigger aperture creates this what we call depth of field, and it's very shallow.
Yeah.
So your subject is in focus, but maybe 2 feet or 3 feet behind it on a field of play is out of focus. And I like to shoot as fast as I can because, like you say, that brings out your subject so much more from the background, and the viewer's eye goes right to the subject. And it's kind of hard to teach because a lot of people are afraid that their focus isn't quite as good. And of course, that was in days when we were manually focusing, so it was much different.
Sure.
But, you know, they want more in focus because their chances of having their subject in focus is better. But at the same time, like you said, everything else is in focus. So the person who's looking at the picture, they're not drawn to what they should be drawn to right away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's also another shot of a football team in a huddle, and you're up above them. It's an aerial. I'm not sure where you were to get up above it, but you know it's the kind of shot that would have been nothing had you been standing at eye level, because you wouldn't have seen what's going on at the center of the huddle.
Right, you'd see one or two players and not everybody around. Yeah, I put a camera on a monopod. It's like one piece of a tripod, and extended it, put a wide angle, and then held it over them and fired it with a trigger remotely. So, you know, a lot of that kind of thing, which is different from most sports photography, came from my days. I started out as a surf photographer, and I worked at Surfer Magazine for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that group is kind of more eclectic and more artistic, and we use different types of lenses, from wide angles to telephotos. And when I jumped on board at Sports Illustrated, most of those photographers didn't use anything that was very wide, or they were all very straight line, you know, long lens, on action stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or on-field action photos. So it was great for me because it was a different look, and the editors liked it. And when I started shooting a lot of golf, I think the bonus was I'm not a golfer. I didn't even know much about golf, you know, when to use a 7-iron or a wood. So I shot it differently than the guys who knew what was going to happen. They said, oh, he's going to do this, so I need to be here. I don't know what he's doing. I'm just going to make a nice picture. So it played really well for me as I worked my way up the ladder.
When you shoot wider, as you're describing, you kind of give more context, especially to somebody who doesn't know the sport that well, right? You see not just
the
golf shot, but where it's going, where it is in relation to everything else on the green.
Or in golf, you might at least see where he's hitting from. Is it a little swale, or, you know, is he in a bunker, or, you know, is there a tree around him? What are the people doing around him? Or it's the same at a baseball stadium or a football field. You see more of what the other players are doing or what the atmosphere is up there. And I'm not the king of it, and I didn't change it all, but our magazine did change a lot through the last, you know, the 10 years after I started there, and people started shooting more with shorter lenses, 70 to 24s or 200 to, you know, 200 millimeters instead of using their 400 or 600 all the time.
Yeah.
And so now it's a really good mix. It's kind of cool.
Well, it's, you know, the ideal sports shot is of interest to anyone who looks at it, even somebody who doesn't know that much about the sport. And I think you've accomplished that many times here.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's human interest. You know, we're kind of looking at mirrors of ourselves. Even like you said, even if we don't play that sport, we still, the emotion of it is the same. You know, the joy, the sadness, whatever it might be, we've all felt that. And to see that in a professional athlete in their atmosphere, well, that's what we can relate to.
Sounds good to me, Robert. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Robert Beck is a Sports Illustrated staff photographer who will talk about his work tomorrow evening at the Box Jelly in Honolulu. It's free and open to the public, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. We had a chance to meet the author of a memoir of military life, Faded Jeans to Army Greens. That was an interesting talk, yeah?
It was. I mean, we think we have ideas about what it means to be in the military, but unless you have close contact, unless you're a military family, and depending upon which branch of the military you're in, the stories that emerge can be really enlightening. That one is particularly so.
Well, Mike Travis was very candid about the way military life had changed him and you know, really kind of knocked him into growing up. And he went back to school after his deployment with much more focus and got a lot of benefits out of it.
That's the good side. And for others, not so much. But his story is, you know, particularly insightful about what can happen. But, of course, that depends on the individual. He was ripe for it.
Exactly.
That's going to do it for us for this week. As we hit Monday, we're going to be taking a look at the EPA lawsuit against Syngenta on Kauai and a new state plan to defeat cancer disparities in Hawaii.
And we'll have holiday music from Streetlight Cadence.
Always good to see them and hear them. And we like to hear from you, too. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Please just be sure to leave us your name, your full name, and the town from which you're calling. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or you can get to me at BKOZHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information on the Conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Gillian Song produces the program. Brian Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday and pick up the conversation.